Welcome to the Alien Wellness Think Tank podcast series. The Think Tank is an emergency medicine organization led by residents for residents to improve the culture of wellness during residency training. Take a listen to our conversations with our wellness strategists and mentors.
Well, everyone, welcome to another edition of Academic Life and Emergency Medicine Wellness Think Tank. My name is Tanner Granowski. I'm one of the senior resident leaders here at the Think Tank. And tonight I'm joined by a panel of residents from around the country, as well as the one and only Jim Dahl, aka White Coat Investor. Thank you so much all for joining us here tonight. Jim, it's so great to have you here tonight. I really appreciate you taking time away from writing on your blog and your work time to talk with us about some financial wellness. You have this amazing...
You're very welcome. I'm glad to be here. In fact, there's nothing I like doing better than spending some time with the people who most need this information, which is people at the beginning of their careers.
Absolutely. It's such a unique spot to find yourself in, this physician financial aspects. And so we have some residents with some questions tonight. But first, I just kind of want to hear, how did you end up doing this? Like, how did you get to where you're at? Did you have some background in business or finances?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I really had no background nor interest in anything financial originally. No, certainly did not have a business degree. My undergraduate major was molecular biology. Went to med school and still really didn't have much interest in it. But after going to residency and looking back through med school and residency, and realizing that I'd been ripped off over and over and over again by financial professionals, I decided I just needed to start learning this stuff on my own. So I lived next to a used bookstore, and I'd go over there and pick up books, and I'd read them. And I read a lot of books. Most of them were terrible, but a few of them were really good. And after a while, I realized that this stuff isn't that hard. It's way easier to learn than medicine. And so I started just kind of sharing what I knew with other people online. And after a few years, I got sick of typing the same thing into internet forums over and over again. And so I literally started the website so I could just post a link to the site, to a blog post, rather than typing the same thing in over and over again. And that's how it got started back in 2011. Obviously, it's boomed since then. And that's been a lot of fun, too, to watch it grow. But that was the original motivation, and that's how I got started on it. It was purely self-taught. And the benefit was these were all questions and issues that I had wrestled with. And so I knew what other doctors were wondering because I dealt with the same questions, looked up the answers, and now I could share them with people.
Wow. That is absolutely crazy that it was just a bookstore next door to you that started it all, and then you went onto the forums and decided to create an amazing website that has literally been one of the best places I've gone to since I've been a resident. So one of the things here at the Wellness Think Tank that we have learned is that there's a lot of things that contribute to wellness. And one of those big things that I wanted to at least talk to you about is the financial wellness, the financial stability of things. So I think we have some residents that have some great questions lined up for you. And we'll go ahead and start with Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah Sebi. I'm a third year resident at Naval Medical Center, San Diego. And so my first question is, what are your thoughts on stopping retirement savings for 2 to 3 years in order to pay off high interest consumer debt, car loans, credit cards, et cetera, at a faster rate? I mean, this is a step that's often advocated by people such as Dave Ramsey, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I hate to see somebody give up free money like you can get from a match in a 401k. High interest credit card debt is such a terrible thing to be carrying for your finances that it's almost worth putting ahead of anything else. I mean, you're not going to see returns of 15, 20, and 30% on your investments. It's just not going to happen. But you're getting a guaranteed 20% return when you pay off a 20% credit card. Mm-hmm. And so that's really is a no-brainer to get rid of at least that toxic kind of debt before you even think about investing. Now, I don't know that you have to get rid of every 2% student loan you have before you invest a dime, but I'd certainly get rid of those credit cards first. And at the same time, it'd be nice if you can at least get any free money like a match from an employer, because that's really part of your salary. But lots of doctors' 401ks don't even offer a match anyway, so that's not really an issue. And that's definitely where their first dollar should go, is getting rid of that debt that they probably really never should have taken out in the first place.
That is definitely a true answer. I know from personal experience that credit card debt is not a good thing to have, and you want to pay that down right away. Alicia, go ahead.
Hello, Alicia Gendy from the University of Iowa. So I remember as a third year medical student, when I was complaining about paying $2 a day for parking, the attending saying, you know, you think you don't have money now. Well, when you're attending, your car gets faster, your house gets bigger, your clothes get fancier, and you still don't have any money. And I thought, well, I don't want to have that problem when I'm making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And then I read in your book, you know, that we have to fight the societal pressure, the expert, or, you know, wear the fancy shoes and drive the fancy car and live in the big house. So how do you recommend that we do that?
Well, it turns out it's immensely difficult not to grow all the way into your income. And this is really hard. It seems unbelievable to a medical student when I tell them that if you can't live on $200,000 a year, you have a spending problem, not an earning problem. But believe it or not, there are attendings all over this country who are having trouble living on $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year. They're just spending it on stuff. And trust me, it's very easy to spend money on stuff. I just came back from a Canada ski trip. I think I spent $4,000 or $5,000 on it. And, you know, as a resident, that would have been an immense percentage of my income. Now, of course, you know, I budgeted for it. It's something I can afford. But the problem is we tend to get too many of those things that we feel like we deserve. And before long, all the money's gone. And so it's really a matter of prioritization. What I tell people is when they come out of residency, they should live like a resident for 2 to 5 years. And the reason for that is because their income just quadrupled or maybe quintupled in emergency medicine, but they're not yet used to that higher income. They can give themselves a little raise, even a 50% raise, which would be huge in corporate America. And they can go out and have a very nice life with 50% more money than they had the year before, while still building incredible amounts of wealth and paying off their student loans in a hurry. Then they can grow slowly into their attending income and then really enjoy the good life when they get there. It turns out if you study happiness, having a slowly increasing standard of living throughout your life is really a key to happiness, rather than having one big jump when you leave residency and then being basically flat the rest of your life. They mentioned at the beginning of the podcast how important financial wellness is. And part of that is the reason is because it allows you to do all the other things that bring in wellness. For example, as you get older, if you're financially set, you can cut back on night shifts or weekends or holidays or total number of shifts you work. And those things are allowed because you've got your finances in order. If you don't have your finances in order, it's a lot harder to take those other steps that can really lead you to longevity in your career and real wellness.
That's such an interesting concept to slowly increase your financial means over time, making it a better overall for your wellness. And
it's totally counterintuitive. But the first time you have a check hit your bank account for $20,000 or $30,000, as most emergency medicine attendings will, the first thing you'll think about is, wow, what kind of a car can I get for $25,000? And it's not uncommon at all for a resident to leave residency with a couple of car payments and a big fat mortgage without actually having ever received an attending paycheck. And so you really have to be careful to guard against that and really decide what your priorities are coming out of residency.
I literally am trying to imagine that right now, because I know the first moonlighting check I got was like, oh man, we have money finally. And then it was, oh, well, I guess we should probably pay off this credit card debt that we've been looking at for a while. Do you have some strategies for ignoring that giant paycheck?
Well, I think the real key is I think to develop a written financial plan before you leave residency. That before you graduate, you've actually written down what you're going to do with those first 12 monthly paychecks. This much is going to go toward retirement. This much is going toward the student loans. This much we're going to blow on something fun. This much we're going to, you know, put toward a house down payment. And this is what we're going to live on. And I think it's important that you don't feel deprived. You've got to increase your standard of living enough that you're like, wow, I made it and I'm being rewarded for getting out of residency, but not so much that you'll never build any wealth. You don't want to be like the emergency medicine doc I ran into a conference a couple of years ago, who was 63 years old and had a net worth of $300,000. After 30 years of attending level paychecks, that was all he had left. And you just, if you're not careful, you can do that. The truth of the matter is most residents or most physicians have already won the game, right? You're 90% of the way there just by earning the money. Now, if you can just not screw up the last 10%, you're going to be very wealthy someday. And so it's just a matter of learning a few more things so you don't screw up that 10%. It reminds me of the Super Bowl a few years ago. If you'll recall, there was a team on the 2-yard line, I think, and all they had to do was run the ball into the end zone. And what they do, they called a pass play and screwed it all up, right? Well, this is you as a doctor. You're on the 2-yard line. Just run the ball into the end zone. And that's really all you got to do with your finances is get the basics right. And the rest you can screw up. And there'll be plenty of money to have a great time, I assure you, as an emergency physician. But you want to make sure you're taking care of business first.
That is probably the best financial analogy I've ever heard. I can totally relate to that. All right. So Ashley, go ahead.
Hey, my name's Ashley Mogul. I'm an intern at Stony Brook on Long Island. My question for you is about disability insurance. I'm curious whether this is something that's important for us to have at all, or if it's important at our stage, or something that's just more important later in the game.
Well, disability insurance is most important to have just before you get disabled. So if you can predict when you get disabled, that's when I'd buy disability insurance. If you're like me and your crystal ball is really cloudy, I'd probably buy it as soon as you can. I think the best time to buy it is probably as an intern. You know, they do sell some to medical students, but it's kind of a real niche product and the limits aren't very high. So I think the time to buy it is as you move into residency. And they won't let you buy as much as you need later, but you should probably buy as much as they will sell you of a good, high-quality, individual disability insurance policy. And what they'll usually sell you is a monthly benefit of maybe $5,000. If you're lucky, maybe $7,000 or $7,500. And basically what that means is if you're disabled at some point during residency, they'll pay you $5,000 a month for the rest of your life. That's not entirely true. They'll pay you until you're about 65. And then disability insurance stops paying. And so that's one thing to keep in mind when you eventually buy disability insurance as an attending, because almost everyone needs to buy more than they can afford as a resident because it's expensive stuff, is that you also need to buy enough of it that you can still save for retirement. Because after 65, when your disability insurance runs out, all you're going to be left with is Social Security. And that's probably not going to be the same standard of living you are enjoying on that disability insurance premium or that disability insurance benefit. So yeah, it's definitely something you need to buy. It's expensive, though, and so everybody gets sticker shock the first time they go to buy it. The typical rates are between 2 and 6% of the amount of income you're trying to protect. So if you buy a benefit that's $50,000 a year, then what it's going to cost you is anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000. And so it's not a small purchase at all. It's a big purchase. But it's also your most valuable asset that you're insuring, which is your ability to earn money in the future. And don't underestimate how much that's worth. I mean, the average emergency physician is making something like $375,000 a year. And if you've got a 30-year career, I mean, how much money are you really insuring here? Something like $10 million. And so you shouldn't think twice about spending a little bit of money to insure that very valuable asset that you have.
Hey, Jim, I'm Nicole. I recently started my first big girl job at the Mayo Clinic and definitely got some disability insurance last year before graduating from residency. At the time, I was told that, especially for females, we wanted to try to purchase and lock in that disability insurance prior to graduation. And we're kind of scared into thinking or believing that after graduation, especially for females, the rates were going to jump quite a bit in terms of, you know, what we could lock in as a lifelong rate as a resident versus after graduation. Is that true? Have you found that to be true, or is that just kind of an old wives' tale?
Well, there's a few things that go into that calculation. The problem with disability insurance is it's complicated, right? Life insurance is black and white, right? You're either dead or you're alive. It's very simple and relatively easy to buy because it's simple. You know, if there are shades of gray in between life and death, we've seen them all as emergency physicians, and they only last about 15 minutes. Disability is just a complicated subject because there's so many different ways to be disabled and so many degrees of disability that it becomes a very complex subject to understand. But bottom line is the younger you are and the healthier you are when you buy it, the better your rate. And so buying it this year instead of next year is almost always going to be cheaper no matter what. But there are a few deals that affect that as you leave residency. One is when you leave residency, sometimes the disability insurance companies consider you to have changed your specialty. They considered you to be a resident, and then they've changed you to be an emergency physician, for example. And it's different with every company. It's different with every specialty. But sometimes they consider you to have a different disability category, basically. For example, an anesthesiologist is much higher risk than a preventive medicine doc. And so they charge more accordingly. So if you're going as a resident from a low risk category to a higher risk category, then it could cost you a lot more when you graduate, whether you're a male or a female. The other thing to keep in mind is disability insurance costs more for women than it does for men. So the general rule for men is they want to buy a gender-specific policy, and the general policy for women is they want to buy a gender-neutral policy and thus take advantage of a little bit lower rate. Sometimes you can also get a group discount by buying during residency or buying while you're part of a big hospital, and so that can go into it as well. So chances are you weren't being lied to when somebody told you to buy the insurance before you left residency. That's usually a good idea. Every year I tend to see a little program as well for residents that are about to graduate that they can buy disability insurance without having to prove they're insurable. And that's not necessarily the best disability insurance policy if you are insurable, but if you're not, it's a great deal. And so if you are somebody with a chronic illness or something like that, it's a great time to get disability as well just before you graduate because they offer that special deal just trying to lock you in for future business, really.
Is there a way to vet these companies or these policies to figure out which ones are actually giving you those deals that are appropriate for you? Or is there a list somewhere? Like how do I figure out which company is giving me the right disability insurance?
Well, here's the good news. There's only five companies, right? There's basically five companies that sell true own occupation, specialty specific disability insurance to doctors. So it's not that hard to keep track of the companies. But the key is not to go to each company. The key is to go to an independent agent and have them show you the policies from all five of those companies for your gender, your health status, your state, and your specialty. And then have them show you the difference in price, have them show you the various options available with each one, have them make a recommendation to you. I mean, these guys make a big, fat, multi-$1,000 commission by selling you this policy. Make them work for it. Make them actually show you how the policy works. And the good disability insurance agents will not have a problem doing that because they know they're going to make a sale and they're going to make money and they want you to get the right policy. And so for your given gender and state and specialty, there's usually a right policy for you. There are occasionally exceptions depending on your health status and that sort of thing. But whereas a preventive medicine doc in New York might want a policy from MetLife, maybe a emergency physician in San Diego might want one from Principal. And so it really varies. I can't say go buy one from one company because one company is not always the best. And the problem, if you go to a captive agent, one who primarily just sells policies for one company, is they're going to tell you their policy is always the best. And that's just not the truth. Sometimes other policies are better. For example, one policy might give you a little bit better rate, you know, or a lot better rate, but only slightly less benefit. And so there's a whole lot more value there rather than going for the very best policy that costs you 50% more. And so you really have to look at it and decide what you want. But as a general rule with disability insurance, you kind of get what you pay for. The more you spend, the more robust the policy is, the more likely it is to cover you in the event of, maybe a gray area disability like low back pain or psychiatric illness or substance abuse, that sort of thing. But in general, this is pretty expensive stuff. You have to buy it through an agent. You might as well enlist that agent's help in helping you compare one policy to another. And if you need a list of agents that have been vetted by somebody, I keep a list on my website. But obviously, I have a conflict of interest there because they also buy ads from me. So if you need a list, then that's where I'd send you because I don't know of any other list. That's why I compiled it.
Perfect. We can find the list on whitecoatinvestor.com. All right, Sarah, do you have another question?
What are your views on credit cards? Because I have, some attendings who are saying, the cash back, the mileage points, et cetera, it's worth it. Take advantage of free money. But then there's always that inherent risk that, you know, it's Christmas time coming up and you spend a little more than you meant to. And, you know, next thing you know, you're carrying a balance. So, you know, what are your thoughts of balancing, you know, that free money versus the risks?
Well, I mean, let's call them what they are, right? They're not credit cards. They're a terrible way to get credit. I mean, just look at the interest rate on your cards. I mean, would you really voluntarily sign up for a loan at 15 or 20 or 30%? Of course not. They're lousy credit instruments. If you need credit, you know, go get a mortgage, go get a student loan, go get something at some sort of reasonable rate with reasonable terms. A credit card is not that. And so what they really are is convenience cards. And why are they convenient? Well, they're convenient because you can, you know, buy something off Amazon and have some consumer protections. And everything you bought for the month, you get this nice write-up at the end of the month that tells you what you bought. And it all comes out of your bank account at once at the end of the month. You know, and that's very convenient. And so they're useful for that convenience. But when you look at the academic studies, it turns out people spend more when they use a credit card. So if you're having trouble spending too much and not saving enough, a great way to cut back is simply to go to cash, because you will spend less cash than you will using a credit card. But if you find yourself carrying a balance on a credit card, you've basically shown yourself that you can't handle a credit card. You really ought to cut it up at that point and just go to a cash or, if you must, a debit card system. And you can buy airplane flights with debit card. You can buy stuff off Amazon with a debit card. You can buy gasoline with a debit card. Sometimes it's a little bit annoying because they put a hold on $50 or $100 in your account. But you can really buy everything you can with a credit card with a debit card. And so while I use credit cards and I get 2% back on my rewards, you know, I think it's something you really have to be careful with, because too many people, including docs, get into the habit of carrying credit card debt. And I think I ran into one the other day that had $70,000 in credit card debt upon coming out of residency. And, you know, that's more than a year's salary as a resident on a credit card, gaining interest at 15 or 20%. It's just way too crazy. And so, you know, I think you have to be careful. If you find yourself using it for credit, credit cards aren't for you.
Oh my gosh, that number makes me sick. $70,000 of credit card debt.
You're not going to like to hear my record for student loan debt either, are you?
Oh, please tell me.
$635,000 for one doctor.
Oh man.
That's just the student loans. That's not anything else.
That's rough.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there in a very bad way. It's not uncommon at all for me to run into people with $350,000 to $450,000 these days. They'll tell you the average is closer to $200,000. But by the time you get out of residency, it's much closer to three.
Now, in terms of student loans, do you have any approaches that you would recommend? Or is it just the, you know, pick a date and that's the payment system that you're going to do until that date's done and it's paid off? Or?
Well, I'm a big fan of getting rid of them early in your career. I think doctors are a lot happier practicing medicine once their student loans are gone. I think they have a lot more financial freedom to quit a bad job. I think they have a lot more financial freedom to do other things in their life they might want to do, like cut back to part-time and raise a family or change their style of practice or whatever when they don't have student loans. So I'm a big fan of paying them off early. Basically, as a resident, it's kind of complicated figuring out how to manage your student loans. Most of the time, the best default is the federal program called Repay, at least for your federal loans, because you get a little bit of a subsidy on the interest through that, which is pretty cool. That's a new program that came out last December. Actually, I guess it's been about a year now. Once you graduate, it becomes very simple. If you're working for a 501c3, basically if you're an academic or otherwise directly employed by a nonprofit hospital, then you should go for public service loan forgiveness. And all those tiny payments you made under the IBR system and the pay-as-you-earn system and the revised pay-as-you-earn system in residency represents the amount that you're going to be forgiven after you make payments for a total of 10 years. And so if that's the case, then you make the minimum payments until you receive that forgiveness. Kind of the typical course for an emergency doc would probably be graduating from med school with a couple hundred thousand in student loans. That grows to about 300,000 during residency. And then over the next 7 years, maybe you pay it back to about 200,000. And then that's the amount that's forgiven in the end. And that's the way public service loan forgiveness works. And it's really great because it goes away tax-free. You know, you don't have to pay any taxes on what's forgiven. It just goes poof, the taxpayer picks it up for you. And so that's a cool benefit if you're working for a 501c3. Everybody else should refinance their loans and make a commitment to live like a resident until they're paid off. And the time period I'm thinking about, especially for an emergency doc, this is very doable, is 2 to 5 years. Don't tell me you can't do it, because I run into people all the time who do it in 6 months, who do it in 17 months, who do it all the time in less than 2 years. I know it can be done in 2 to 5 years. And the way you do it is by living like a resident. If you go to that attending income of $250,000 and you're still living on $50,000, that's $200,000 a year you can throw at your student loans. Now, it's a little bit less because you got to pay more in taxes as an attendee. But still, even if you're throwing $150,000 at a loan at your student loans, they go away very quickly. There's no reason they should be there in 10 or 15 years. You can pay them off in 2 to 5, especially with the lower interest rate you can get by refinancing.
Alicia, do you have another question?
Yeah, I do. Like you, I served in the military for a couple of years, and now I'm a non-traditional student. So how does your advice kind of differ for us non-traditional students, being that we're a little ahead of our medical colleagues, but behind our social peers in the game of saving for retirement?
Well, I don't know that the advice changes a whole lot, because as far as your financial life, for the most part, unless you've got some system that's going to help you get ahead, like maybe the GI Bill or something like that, you're really at the same place as somebody that's 2 or 5 years younger than you as far as when your income's going to come in. And so it's still really the key is what you do with your finances your first few years out of residency. I mean, if you tell me what you do with your money in your first year out of residency, I can predict the rest of your financial life with surprising accuracy. And so the key is really having a plan when you come out of residency and making the most of that jump to an attending income. The benefits some people do have when they're non-traditional is sometimes they had retirement money coming into medical school. And a great option for using that, aside from paying for medical school, is to do Roth conversions of any tax-deferred money you had in medical school. Because your income is so low, you can basically convert tax-deferred money to tax-free money with no tax cost. So that's a really slick trick for somebody that had retirement accounts. But I find that's a pretty rare person. And for the most part, all you get by going back to medical school is you've got some additional maturity and some additional experience and maybe a little more focus when you're in residency and as you come out on the importance of saving for retirement and saving for a down payment and that kind of stuff. And certainly that's an advantage. But financially, I don't know that it gets you ahead very much of your peers who may be a couple of years younger than you. But as far as catching up to your college roommates, the only way to do it is live like a resident. And you'll catch up to them. I mean, doctors make good money. You can catch up to them as long as you use that greatest asset you have, which is your income. As long as you use that wisely, you can catch up.
Awesome. Thank you. Ashley, do you have another question?
So people talk a lot about like building your credit. And I feel like a lot of ways people talk about doing that is taking out credit cards and getting them to increase your limits and things like that. But then as we were talking about earlier, that's not always the best thing to do. Do you have any advice for building credit or the importance of doing that so that once we're out of residency and there's like big purchases we need to get and loans we need to get for those things that we can do that more easily?
Well, for most docs, the only things they really need to borrow money for is usually their education, which at this stage in your career, you probably have already got all kinds of great student loans. And the last thing's probably a mortgage. The truth is most doctors can buy a car with cash. You know, when you start having paychecks hitting your account that have $20,000 or $30,000 in them, you know, you can go buy a car with cash. You can save up for it for a couple of months and then just go buy a car. So you don't really need to be, you know, having this great credit score to be able to borrow money all the time. So I think that's a little bit of a fallacy that the financial press likes to put out there, that you have to have this awesome credit score. I mean, you really might only need it once more in your life to buy a mortgage. So I don't think it's something you should be focused on too much. But the thing to keep in mind is the way to get a high credit score is just to pay your bills as you said you would. If you make all the payments as required on your student loans, and maybe you put your gasoline on a credit card, that's going to be more than enough credit to get the best possible rate you can get on a mortgage. You know, you really don't have to have 12 different credit cards. You don't have to have a credit score monitoring service that sends you an email every week telling you your credit score went up by a point or two. You don't need that stuff. Just pay your bills and your credit score will be fine. And you'll be able to buy anything you need. And you'll have people lining up out the door wanting to loan you far more money than you should ever borrow. So I think there's probably too much focus on credit scores. In fact, the amazing thing is how quickly you can repair a bad credit score. I mean, I know all kinds of people who short sailed their home back in the housing crisis that were able to buy a new one just 2 years later. And so it really doesn't take that long to repair credit. And the way you do that is by doing what you said you were going to do and actually paying your bills. And that's the biggest factor that goes toward your credit score anyway, is whether you're paying your bills. And so that's what I would do. Now, if you've never borrowed money for anything, if you don't have any student loans, you never had a credit card, I don't think it's the end of the world for you to get a credit card and put, you know, a purchase or two a month on it to build credit. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. You know, I don't think you got to actually go out and try to get a credit score. Most people have already borrowed plenty of money to have an excellent credit score.
It's really true how the amount of push for credit score has popped up in the last few years. Like, my apps literally for my banks and my credit cards have been pinging me for the past 12 to 24 months. Hey, have you checked your credit score in the last week? And it's like, it really doesn't change that fast.
Yeah, I don't go care. Check it sometime. I mean, you don't get any better deal on a mortgage once you get to about 740 or 750. You know, it doesn't matter if you have 770 or 800, but you know what? If you pay all your bills, that's the range you're going to be in.
Yep.
It's just not that hard. I had to check my credit score to open a bank account the other day. They told me my score was 820. I said, that's really good. I usually only see elderly people with scores like that. And I'm like, well, maybe that's because I live my financial life like an elderly person. I actually pay my bills. I don't know. But, you know, the truth of the matter is 820 doesn't get you anything more than 750 does. So there's no point in spending all kinds of time and effort trying to game it unless you've, you know, had a short sale or had a bankruptcy or had something really terrible in the recent past. Probably shouldn't be buying a house anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Don't spend the money you don't have.
Right.
I've read your book and I've kind of dabbled on the website here and there trying to learn some things, but you know, I've done the basics. I do the retirement that's provided by our hospital. I have a basic, you know, life insurance and some disability, but there's so much else left after that. I feel like it's overwhelming. What are kind of the next basic steps to take after you just do those things that are just kind of spoon fed to you?
Well, here's the great thing. There really isn't that much else as a resident. As you recall, the key to building wealth as a physician is what you do your first few years as an attending. I mean, really, even if you save a little more as a resident on your piddly $50,000 a year salary, it's not going to make a huge difference compared to not growing into that attending salary as quickly. That's really where the bang for your buck is, and I want residents to focus on that. So they come out of residency with a plan for that money in their first year out. And you'd be amazed what you can accomplish financially with an attending salary and resident tastes. I mean, you can really save a lot of money in a hurry. My wife and I, we became millionaires 7 years out of residency. And the reason why is because we grew very slowly into our attending income. And that was really all we did. There was nothing fancy about the investments. We just kept living like we did as a resident. A little bit better each year. You know, we certainly weren't living like residents 7 years out of residency. We bought the fancy dream attending house 4 years out. But we didn't buy it the first month out. And that made all the difference in the world. And so if you as a resident are learning about some financial stuff, if you've got your disability and if anybody else depends on you, your life insurance in place, you're doing a little bit of savings toward retirement, like getting a match if the hospital 401k offers it to you, otherwise putting it in a Roth IRA, I think you're doing great. I mean, I didn't have all that much money saved and coming out of residency. I think we had a four-figure net worth. Maybe it was low five figure, but we didn't have much. And most residents are coming out with dramatically negative net worth because they've got a bunch of student loans. I think the key is don't try to win as a resident. Just try to, you know, keep your head above water. Make sure you've got that key insurance in place. Start learning about finances and hit the ground running hard as an attendee. I think that's the key. I ran into a resident the other day. He was maxing out his 403B and his 457 and a Roth IRA for him and his spouse. It just makes you wonder, what are you living on? And it turned out, well, he was living on his wife's salary is what he was living on, which is perfectly fine. If you've got two salaries, sure, you can save some more than you otherwise could. But the bottom line is don't try to win the game as a resident. Just put yourself in a position to win it as an attendee.
That is brilliant advice. I think that's one of the things that terrifies me the most is that I'm not doing enough. And in reality, it sounds like as a resident, I just need to get the basics down and get set up for after residency.
Absolutely. I think if you will focus on learning how to be a good emergency doc, and if you will focus on getting, you know, figuring out who you are and really understanding you and what you want out of your career and trying to make that first job, you know, your last job, that will get you a lot further, I think, than saving an extra $1,000 a year as a resident. Don't get me wrong, getting in that habit of savings is important, but I don't think that's where the focus needs to be as a resident. You just have too much income coming at you later in your career for that to be the key. Sometimes it helps as well to live like a resident when you realize half of the world or half of the U.S. has less money than you do as a resident. You know, I mean, the median household income is about $50,000 or $55,000 a year. So you're basically at the 50th percentile as a resident. You know, if you're having trouble living on that, you ought to take a look around because half the U.S. is living on less than that, and you can do it too.
Yeah, that is a really good perspective to take, is that even though a resident salary doesn't seem like a lot, it actually is a really solid salary for our country. So
absolutely. Middle class income. That's what it is.
I think Nicole had a question that she wanted to ask.
This is not super useful or practical at all, but I just am kind of wondering, what's the craziest thing you've heard or the biggest in your eyes mistake that you've ever heard that you've, like a doc has done, like the wildest purchase, or you're like, wow, I can't believe you did that. You know, kind of a tall tale, big fish kind of story.
I don't know that I have one that's particularly terrible. Sometimes I just see a long history of making bad decision after bad decision after bad decision. And it's not like any one of them wasn't recoverable, but it was just too many of them and nobody's income could keep up with that. But I think probably the worst place you can get in is, you know, getting divorced repeatedly. You know, every time you get divorced, not only are you going to be paying alimony, but your assets are going to be cut in half. And those student loans aren't going to be cut in half, I can assure you of that. So you get divorced repeatedly, that's going to hurt you badly. If you change jobs and move repeatedly, that's going to get you badly too. So really the mantra of one house, one spouse, one job is really a key to building wealth in life. It turns out that being married actually helps you build a little more wealth, but you got to do it right the first time. You really can't be having gone through serial marriages and expect to build much wealth. It makes me sad when I run into, you know, a 65-year-old doc who's working because he has to, because he's got all this alimony to pay and, you know, still hasn't really acquired a nest egg. And so I think the key is to realize that you don't want to be there someday. You know, someday you want to be the person who can, you know, be part-time at 55 or can drop your nights at 50 or, you know, figure out what you want out of your career. Maybe you want to transition to something else. Believe it or not, lots of docs get 5 or 10 years out and realize maybe medicine isn't what I want to be doing. The great thing about emergency medicine is you can transition out part-time by cutting your shifts back gradually and do that other thing. But you have to have your finances in order to be able to do it.
All right. So we're kind of getting a little bit towards the end here. So we'll just kind of hit the last few questions that we have. Sarah, do you have anything else?
I just have one last question, somewhat military specific. Do you generally advocate military personnel buy or rent when they're, you know, potentially moving every 2 to 3 years?
Well, the issue with buying when you're not going to be around for very long is that the transaction costs are so high. Once you've bought and sold a few homes, you realize, you know, it costs me about 5% of the value of the home to get in and about 10% of the value of the home to get out. Now, some of that goes to the realtor, about 6% when you get out goes to the realtor. But the house usually sits empty for a couple of months. You got to fix up a few things. You end up paying some of the buyer's costs. It just all adds up. And that's really what it is. A round trip ticket costs about 15% of the value of the home. So for you to break even, you've got to have the house appreciate that 15% while you're in it. And at a rate of, you know, 3% a year, which is about average, that's about 5 years. And so what I tell people is if you're going to be in residency for 3 years or you're going to be in a military station for 2 years or 3 years, you know, you're really gambling, hoping that you're going to come out ahead by buying. And so what people end up doing is they end up having these rental properties in the last place they served. And that's even worse because, you know, then you're an absentee landlord and that's really a pain to manage. Now, if the real estate market goes crazy while you own that home, sure, you might do okay, come out of it all right. But as a general rule, I think you're better off renting until you're out of the military. I just think it works out better. and can't recall talking to anybody that really thought it worked out great to buy and sell a home every 2 or 3 years for 20 years and then settle down. It just never works out well. I think you'd be better off putting a little extra into savings toward a home down payment for your eventual dream home and just renting. And there's lots of great benefits to renting. A lot of people think, oh, rent's throwing money away. Well, property taxes is throwing money away. Insurance is throwing money away. You know, fixing the busted up floor because you had a leak is throwing money away. You know, replacing the carpet is throwing money away. You know, there's lots of things a homeowner does that throws money away. And so I don't think you should feel bad to be a renter when you're at a situation in life where it makes sense to rent.
Alicia?
I think you kind of answered mine already. Like my last question would be like, if you could do one thing as a resident to kind of set yourself up for success, what would that one thing be?
Well, I think the key is that written plan for the first year. Literally sit down and think, how am I going to use that money for my first year? And by the time you sign your contract by December or January or February or whatever, your third year of residency, you're going to know about how much you're going to be paid for the next year. And you can sit down and figure out how much is going to go to taxes and figure out how much you want to put toward your student loans and how much you want to, you know, put toward retirement accounts. And I think really actually sitting down and writing that out as a spending plan and looking forward to it, you know, planning some cool stuff, planning a cool trip or, you know, a cool purchase you've been putting off and really enjoying it, but actually having a written plan. Because if you just do what comes naturally, you will spend it all. You really will. It seems crazy, I know, but it happens all the time. I see it happen over and over and over again. And people come to me 2 or 3 years out going, okay, I've realized my way is not working. It's easy to spend that much money. It really is easy to blow through a lot of money as an attending physician.
It's like packing for a vacation. If you bring the biggest suitcase, you're going to fill it.
Absolutely. Your spending will grow to your income if there is nothing else to constrain it.
All right. Ashley, do you have any other questions?
Just briefly, to what extent does this sort of plan change for any of us who might go on to do a fellowship instead of going straight out to attending life?
Well, I think basically you're extending your residency, but it depends on the fellowship. You know, if the fellowship is one of those where you're working half-time shifts and you're actually making a pretty decent income, now there's a lot of fellowships out there where you might make $100,000 or $120,000 a year. Then you're at kind of an intermediate stage. And I think it's time to start acting like an attendee, still living on that resident salary, but, you know, maybe starting to build a little bit of wealth. You know, put a little bit toward retirement accounts, put a little bit toward the student loans, et cetera. The other thing a fellowship does for you is it makes, if you're going to do a fellowship, there's a better chance you're going to end up in academia than otherwise. And so if you do end up in academia, that's a great opportunity to get even more money forgiven through the public service loan forgiveness. Because not only do you have the 3 years of small payments you made as a resident, or 4 years at some residencies, but you also might have a year or two of small payments you made as a fellow. And so you might really only make 4 or 5 years of the big fat attending payments. And that means all the rest of that gets forgiven. And so if you're going to be a fellow, I think you ought to give some serious thought to spending a few years in academics and really going for public service loan forgiveness. But other than that, it's kind of an intermediate step between residency and attending that. Not that that's a bad thing, because those intermediate steps help you really learn to grow into your income gradually. That was one of the huge benefits I had being a military doc, is I came out of residency and I only got paid about $120,000 as an attending. And so, you know, we couldn't grow into really the classic emergency physician attending lifestyle. We simply didn't have the money. And so we were forced to grow gradually into that lifestyle. And I think that was helpful to us. And I suppose a resident gets a little bit of that benefit, or a fellow gets a little bit of that benefit as well.
That's great. I didn't even think of the fellowship side of things. One of the things that I've struggled with is I've heard that I need like a financial advisor or somebody to kind of help guide me through this process or over the next 5, 10, 15 years. How do I choose a financial advisor, or where do I go to do that?
Well, once more, if people are asking for a list, the only list I know of is the one I've vetted on my website. They're all advertisers on the website, though, so you should be aware of that. But here's the way I look at it. The first thing you need to decide is whether you need an advisor at all. It's very reasonable to do this stuff on your own. It's going to require you to put some time in, to read some books, spend some time on websites like mine, and learn the ins and outs and the language of finance. You know, if you don't know a Roth IRA from an expense ratio, you probably shouldn't be managing your own investments. And that's okay. Probably 80% of docs want or need a financial advisor. And so my goal with those docs is that for them to find somebody that gives good advice at a fair price. What you have to realize is the fair price is very high. Okay, financial advice is expensive stuff. It's going to cost you thousands of dollars a year to get good financial advice. And the reason why is most financial advisors are paid, and I'm talking real financial advisors, not the ones masquerading as commissioned salesmen, but the real financial advisors, most are paid as a percentage of your assets under management. And so as your net worth grows to $1 million or $2 million, they're going to be getting paid $10,000 to $20,000 a year if they're charging 1% a year. It's a lot of money. And so you got to realize, well, you know, maybe it's worth it to me to learn to do at least a little bit of this stuff on my own. And there's nothing that says you can't use an advisor for a few years. There's nothing that says you can't just use them for part of your needs, you know, just your financial planning or just your asset management. And there are cheaper ways to do it. But I think the key is to, you know, number one, make sure you're getting good advice because there's no price too low for bad advice. And number two, making sure you're paying a fair price. And if you spend some time on some of the articles on my website talking about how the financial advisory industry works, you'll get a sense for what a fair price is and how that can be determined and what good advice looks like. Some people say that, you know, by the time you know enough to pick a good financial advisor, you know enough to do it on your own. And there's some truth to that. But I think you can hire a good financial advisor that can help you and guide you and help you control the most important thing, which is your own behavior in a bear market. So you don't, you know, buy high and sell low. But there's nothing wrong with hiring some help if you need it. Just realize it's going to be expensive and that there's a lot of sharks out there masquerading as financial advisors.
Real quick before we wrap up, one kind of follow-up question to that. Besides your book, White Coat Investor, what other couple books would you recommend we read for financing for our advice?
One of the first ones I recommend is a book by William Bernstein, who's a neurologist by training but now manages money. He wrote a book called If You Can. Just those three words. If you Google If You Can PDF, you'll find a free copy of it. It's 16 pages. You can get through it. And it lays out the basics of putting together an investing plan. It also refers you, it's basically five sections or five chapters, and each one gives you a homework assignment, which is another book. And so really, I'm getting five books out of that one. But that's a great place to start. If you hate reading financial stuff, you can get through that book. And so I think that's a great place to start. It's not physician specific, but it is millennial specific. And I think it's a great first investing primer to read. It will really give you a lot of the key information you need to know to kind of be armed against the financial industry and its tactics as you move into your financial lives.
Well, we've definitely had some awesome questions and phenomenal answers. I know I definitely have learned something. I'm pretty sure everyone else here as well has learned something about our financial future and what we need to focus on. Jim, do you have any final words, thoughts, anything that you want to pass on to the residents on the Wellness Think Tank?
Yeah, don't buy whole life insurance.
Simple and succinct. I love it.
Somebody out there trying to sell it to you, either as a resident or a young attendee. And there's really no reason to even consider it in those stages of your life.
Jim, thank you so much for spending time here on the Wellness Think Tank with us. We really, really appreciate your efforts in helping educate us on the financial wellness. Make sure everybody, if you get a chance, go to his website and check out whitecoatinvestor.com. We look forward to seeing the future of the Wellness Think Tank continuing to progress.
And that wraps up a great episode from the Wellness Think Tank. Special thanks to our exclusive sponsors, US Acute Care Solutions. You can reach us also on Twitter at WellnessTT. Until next time, remember that residency training should be about thriving and not just surviving.